From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea and for Celeste Headley. On today's show, we're going to get a preview of this weekend's Music Midtown Festival in Atlanta. We're going to add some more songs to our Georgia playlist. That's coming up. But first, earlier this week, we spent an hour talking about music from Macon and listened back to our conversation with Greg Allman.
Rock and roll was born in the South. And saying Southern rock is just like saying rock. I mean, rock is Southern.
We wanted to hear some of your favorite songs sung by Macon musicians. Here are your first thoughts.
This is Deborah Hardigree calling from Arnoldsville, Georgia. One of my favorite Allman Brothers songs is Blue Sky. It's just such a happy song. It makes me feel happy, and you have to dance when you hear it.
This is Edwina Thornton. One of my favorite, it's an instrumental, Little Martha by Duane Allman. And I love the fact that in the song, you can hear him breathe, and the intensity of the music is just phenomenal. And it shows our great Southern guitarist that we all love.
Great tune, Little Martha. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show.
Oh, 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 I'm boring, so I'm taking my time on my ride. Oh, 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 I'm boring, so I'm taking my time on my ride.
Music Midtown returns for its sixth year at Piedmont Park in Atlanta this weekend. That was 21 Pilots, one of the acts on the bill for the two-day festival. It's changed a lot since it was founded in 1994. This year's lineup includes a noticeably younger cast of artists like 21 Pilots, Deadmau5, also Kesha. Kesha's back. Ooh. Peter Conlon is co-founder of Music Midtown and is president of Live Nation Atlanta, which produces the festival. He joins me now. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
So you founded this festival back in 1994 with Alex Cooley. Alex Cooley passed away sadly last year. Remind us, what was your original idea for this?
Well, it was really Alex. I mean, he came to see me one day and said, I want to do a festival. And if anybody, or again, if anybody knew Alex's history, that back in the 60s and 70s, he did very large festivals when you could. You know, the International Pop Festival in 69, you know.
Woodstock of the South.
Well, it actually was better than Woodstock because, one, it actually made money and they never lost control of it. It's just we didn't have any press down here like they did in New York, so they didn't cover it. But it was pretty phenomenal for him to pull it off. And that was actually his first event he ever did as a promoter. He started big. But basically, it was hard after that to do them. The cities and municipalities, I mean, even that one was a fight, turned against him, so they kind of went away. And then he decided that the new way to do it would be an urban-based festival, mm-hmm. and he wanted to try one, and he just came in and said, look, let's do it. Very short fuse. I felt we should wait a year. He didn't want to, and we threw the first one together pretty quickly.
The festival went on a six-year hiatus in 2005 because of declining ticket sales, rising costs. What were the lessons that you learned during that interregnum?
Well, it really wasn't those factors particularly. It was a lack of cooperation.
Ah.
You know, the city at that time, the leadership was very pro-neighbor, very anti-event. And I just felt that the atmosphere was just too much of a struggle because these events are very risky. They're a lot of work, and unless you have a lot of cooperation. And then I decided to try it again because we had a very smart mayor who understood the benefit culturally and financially of these things and who was going to be supportive and has been.
So you say the political climate changed with regard to big, large outdoor concert events. How has the economic climate changed? Is the festival economy better?
It's, you know, it got real crowded the last few years. I don't know if you've seen a lot of festivals canceled this year because everybody just thought they'd try one and it's not that easy. They're very expensive. You know, the margins are pretty tight. You know, at the end of the day, you're victim to people's, you know, decisions on whether to buy a ticket or not, and then also weather, you know, being a big factor. But since we started in 94, the main change has been the cost of talent, which has gone through the roof.
Probably because talent can't make money making records anymore, so they've got to make money touring, right?
Yeah, back in the 90s and 80s, the bands made around 90% of their income on records, and they toured to promote those records. Nowadays, they make about 90% of their income on touring and about 10% on the recording.
Can't blame them. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Are you going to go to Music Midtown this weekend? What do you think about the lineup? Who do you want to see? Tweet us at OST Talk or join our conversation happening at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. My guest is Peter Kunlun. He is the co-founder of Music Midtown. He's president of Live Nation Atlanta, which is putting on the festival in Piedmont Park. Let's go into this year's lineup. As we mentioned before, some noticeably younger acts on the bill than previous years. Is this intentional?
Yeah. Last year, we were a little too old, I think. There's a reluctance on older fans to come to festival situations if there's a younger crowd. So this year we really did skew younger.
But older fans have money for it to go to a festival. It's, you know, it's a great value this ticket is, but what is it, $135? I mean, that's an expense.
Yeah. I mean, it's I think the most reasonably priced festival in the country for the value, but older fans are much more comfort oriented. And don't really want to stand for a long time or walk around.
They need expensive amenities.
Yeah, and they also, they don't want to be around younger fans. So when you mix the two groups,
today. It
doesn't work as well. So if you want to do a festival, just a bunch of older acts for older people will work, but you can't mix the acts up.
Okay. I want to play two clips of tape back-to-back for you. This is we spoke to some people in Atlanta about their thoughts on this year's headliners. Morgan Smith is from Conyers, Georgia. She wanted to go to Music Midtown last year to see Drake, but did not, and doesn't plan to go this year. Let's listen.
I don't know. The lineup is just different. I think it probably will appeal to older people who are probably, like, maybe in their 40s, who know who the Killers are.
Ouch. For all of the older millennials, I say ouch. Now, here's one clip here from Casey from Dallas, Texas. She says that she would go to Music Midtown but has to work.
Well, Beck's going too, and I really like Beck. So, but yeah, the lineup, it's good. Leon Bridges is going to be there.
There's a young person who likes the older acts. That's nice. So, look, highly unscientific sample, Peter, but do you, in looking at your ticket sales, do you think that this year's lineup is succeeding in its intended effect of reaching a younger audience?
Yeah, definitely. I didn't understand the first comment. I mean, she wanted to go to Drake, but she didn't go. I mean, okay.
Point taken.
And the Killers, I mean, they're the only act that you could say might have a little more of an adult, but if you look at all the other acts, 21 Pilots, et cetera, they're very young. So it is not appealing to an older audience at all, but it's a good mix of all types of music and very current acts at the same time. If you look at the overall layout of acts, it's a very strong, and it may be one of our strongest lineups.
GPB's Ricky Bevington spoke with Bill Doors. He runs the music blog Hissing Lawns, and Bill told her that the Music Midtown ticket price really is a good deal. Let's listen.
$135 seems like a bargain to me, but I will say that most music festivals in that regard seem like bargains. When you start parsing the price, they're almost always bargains, I think.
Peter, you can just say amen if you want.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at a lot of the artists, you know, we just had 21 Pilots play Gwinnett a month or so back. You'll pay $65 for one act, maybe more.
Right.
I think ours is more reasonable than other festivals because a lot of festivals are $250, $350 for the weekend. So given that same philosophy, we're even more of a bargain.
We're talking to Peter Kunlun. He's co-founder of Music Midtown, happening in Piedmont Park. Peter, Atlanta's music festival scene has been growing since you started this back in the 90s. You got the Shaky Knees, Tomorrow World. Are you concerned about competition, people flooding the market?
No. There's most things fine. They're level, and no one's been as successful as we are. And a lot of festivals this year are actually, if you've seen them go away, like Tomorrowland, that just couldn't find a niche. So it's a competitive business, but Music Midtown is Music Midtown.
How do you see it evolving into the future? What do you want it to be?
You know, Alex always wanted it to kind of embody current music. You know, he really wanted, which we still try to do, is open people up to other acts they might not see. I mean, the point is you come and you buy a ticket because you're a huge fan of 21 Pilots, but then during the day you get to see Leon Bridges or Big Boy and you become a fan. So it's really been trying to educate people to all genres at the same time. It's why, you know, a lot of festivals are all the same type music, and it's why ours has always been very eclectic.
Who are you looking forward to seeing most?
I like The Killers. I like 21 Pilots, Leon Bridges, The Coat Hangers, Group Love. I mean, there's a lot of different acts I want to see.
Yeah. What's it like being present at a festival like this when you're the guy in charge? I mean, can you pay attention to the music, or is it just nonstop stress?
No, I have, you know, the reason this thing's successful is I think, the best people in the business working with me. We have an incredible production team, a great marketing team. You know, we've been down there in meetings all week, laying out how we do things. Usually I'm going around just seeing things and available if there's any questions, but it's not like crisis management or anything, no.
So tell us about the advantages or disadvantages of doing this festival in Atlanta. What are the dynamics that are particular to the city?
We don't have a lot of green space here. I mean, the park is relatively small compared to other cities' parks. That's always a challenge. We have limited mass transit compared to other cities, and that's somewhat of an issue. We've been a little too neighbor-oriented in past years, although that seems to be getting a little better, where people realize the greater good. You know, this festival generates over $50 million a year in economic benefit for the city. And I think cities define really culturally by what happens there. There should be things going on here every week like there are in Chicago and New York. So those are, you know, kind of the challenges. The benefit is it's always been a great music city. Alex started doing shows here in the 60s and really brought music to the South at a time when it was very unpopular to do rock music here. He had to fight all the powers that be. Now we take it for granted because those same acts are on Nike commercials. But in those days, you know, they were undermining America's youth.
Yeah. Well, Peter Conlin is the co-founder of Music Midtown. He's president of Live Nation Atlanta. And when does the festival start?
Tomorrow at noon.
All right. Fantastic. Good luck with it and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Before the break, I talked with the co-founder of Music Midtown about this year's lineup. One of the groups playing is the Coat Hangers, a staple in Atlanta's punk rock scene. We asked two of the band's members to add two songs to our Georgia playlist. The rules are simple, you'll recall. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by another Georgian, and they cannot be one of your songs. So let's find out what songs they suggested.
My name's Meredith Franco. I play in the Coat Hangers. We're from Atlanta, Georgia.
I play bass.
Hey, my name's Julia Kugel, also sometimes Crooked Coat Hanger. And I play guitar in the Coat Hangers from Atlanta, Georgia. The first song we want to talk about for the Georgia playlist is the Subsonics. Their song Frankenstein. They call me Frankenstein. I was designed. My parts out of line and electric fine. It is so strong that they can't be denied. No. I think it's one of the first songs that we actually heard by them, and it's just so cool. It's just really a cool
we
song.
Learned how to play it.
Yeah, we did learn how to play it. We were almost going to cover it. Actually, we should.
We
do
should.
That.
Yeah.
What are we doing? We gotta write these things down. They call me Frankenstein. I was not baptized. I broke out the Ten Commandments and it felt just fine. Yeah, you thought that you could stop me, but you shouldn't have tried. It just has kind of like an FU attitude to it. It's like a really great sound. I don't remember what exactly I was doing. Might have been smoking weed.
It's a good bet.
It's like a creepy, like...
super creepy and like kind of... yeah, his voice is really unique. And it kind of like starts off like very like... what's that word? It kind of puts you in a trance, you know, like da 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 da, and you're like, what? Where are we going? We're going somewhere weird. I guess I don't even know if it has a chorus. Really, it just has like a really cool guitar freakout part. Mm-hmm. And every time we see him play it, it's completely different. And that's one of the best things, is when an artist just is an artist. It doesn't put on a show, but has their own show, and you're watching this thing that's happening. It's really exciting. But you couldn't cry your eyes on what you're learning to spy from Frankenstein. From Frankenstein. Yeah, what you seen in me. It's really real and really raw and comes from somewhere. You know, it's like Billie Holiday, like, never sang a song twice the same way. It's kind of like that. It's like, oh, whoa. It's like, ah, rad. I wonder what he's going to do now. And it just goes just crazy. It's like, wow, wow, wow.
When I hear it, I'm just like, ah. Oh. And I always want to do this for some reason.
Just Thriller dancing. Dance.
The second song we picked is the Black Lips' Bad Kids. The Black Lips are based in Atlanta.
Bad kids, all my friends are bad kids, product of no dad kids, kids like you and me.
We are minority, respect for authority, play well with others, from all your mothers.
Kind of harkens back to our youth when we would just throw things, you know, and like...
just go crazy.
Yeah, just, you know, throw empty beer cans, and everyone would just go off in a friendly way, but... that's kind of what we took from the Atlanta music scene in the beginning, was just being wild. Just the ability to be wild, and no one really was policing you.
It's kind of like an anthem.
Kind of like empowering song for all the people that grew up with nothing, getting picked on, and then being like, whatever, we're bad kids. You're like, hey, we're from the South. Really good, good people, but if you cross us, you're gonna probably get stabbed. And that's kind of the South. The South has a swagger to it, and it's more about the feel rather than the...
you can feel that, like, what everyone has been through, and like,
yeah,
honest.
That was Meredith Franco and Julia Kugel of the Atlanta-based punk rock group The Coat Hangers. You can catch them perform at this weekend's Music Midtown Festival in Atlanta. Do you have a nomination for the Georgia Playlist? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at OST Talk or connect with us at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. Like you and me. Well, it's been a fun week for me here filling in for Celeste Headlee on Second Thought. We talked about the final months of Franklin Roosevelt's life down in Warm Springs. We celebrated music in my city, Macon. And we also talked about the high cost of HIV medication in Atlanta. Now it's time to sit back, relax, and celebrate Friday. Let's head to the break room.
With the iPhone 7, we've done something that at first seems counterintuitive, and then is. We've made it worse.
I really don't think I have cancer.
Well, nobody ever thinks they have cancer. The symptoms can take many different forms, such as runny nose, mild cough, stress.
Lies are the new truth. Yes, more than ever, people today are living an entirely fact-free lifestyle.
Joining us in the break room this week are Amy Condon. She's the associate editor for Savannah Magazine. Hey there, Amy.
Hey, how are you doing today?
I'm just lovely. I imagine that Sam Burnham is as well, curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Good to have you with us, Sam.
Good to be here.
Also with us, Tamika DePriest is Senior Director of Communications at Emory University. Thanks for being here, Tamika.
Happy Friday. Glad to be here.
Happy Friday to you. Happy Friday as well to Stefan Turkheimer, is a lawyer and editor for Georgia Poll. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Adam.
Apple unveiled the iPhone 7 last week. The smartphone, for the most part, looks similar to past models except for one big thing.
We removed the headphone jack. And that's all. That's the newness right there. It's just the lack of a thing that was there, and now it's not. It's gone. It's not there anymore. Ta-da!
Now, Apple's new earbuds are still going to work if you plug them into the phone's charge port, the lightning port at the bottom. But if you want to charge your phone and listen to stuff at the same time, you're going to need to buy a $40 adapter. Amy, let's start with you. As a fellow journalist, did this give you a little bit of a crisis? Did you have flashes to like needing to do work in the airport and you can't charge your phone and listen at the same time?
I have to admit I'm a laggard when it comes to like new phones, and I let people worry about that stuff. And then I go, oh, okay, then I might adopt it. But if I think it's stupid, I won't adopt it ever. And I'm kind of like... Which sounds really judgy. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's not judgy at all. You're letting other people be the leading edge. That's very brave.
Only on certain types of technology.
Okay. Anybody in the Atlanta crew want to defend this?
There's no defending it. I mean, Bluetooth headsets are the worst. Mine drops every 90 seconds. If I wanted to listen to only 2/3 of music, then I would, you know, listen to the radio.
Yeah.
I really liked what Ricky Bevington said about it. It looked like you had the electric toothbrush head stuck in your ear.
Oh, my God.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I'm just planning to get more usage out of my iPhone 6. I mean, I'll just be honest. And like Amy, I would let the early adopters sort of work out the kinks on iPhone 7. But I am looking forward to the whole water-resistant feature. So maybe I'll get on board with 7S.
Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. All I know
is 14.
I had to buy an audio interface for my phone this week, and back in the day, it was just a $40 thing that plugged into the headphone jack. But then I was thinking that's not a good investment right now because I'm gonna have a 7 in like a year. So I spent $130 on a lightning-based interface, and I just want to hurt someone. But anyway,
that doesn't
let's
make any
just
sense.
Move
phones,
on.
Phones used to have microphones included in them, and you could speak into them. You didn't have to buy an audio thing. Sorry.
Right.
Well, I need a thing for an external microphone because I'm a radio guy. Leave me alone. Anyways, let's talk about something that actually matters. Let's talk about diversity in Georgia. For years, the Atlanta suburb of Norcross was a predominantly white area, but now whites make up less than 20% of the total population. Hispanics are the majority. This week, the Boston Globe, of all places, profiled 7 white residents of Norcross who've struggled to adjust to this rapid demographic shift in their community. It's not the first time that a major out-of-state news outlet has jumped on this story. Atlanta crew, why do we think that this little Atlanta bedroom community is suddenly so interesting to the rest of the country?
Honestly, I think it's because the Boston Globe didn't want to look at the suburbs of Boston for their Trump supporters that were not very friendly towards new immigrants. And they were like, oh, where can we make a cartoon? Let's go to the South and find, various Trump supporters who are not from Massachusetts. I mean, like, Trump got 38% of our primary, 57% of the Massachusetts primary, and yet somehow they had to travel, 1,500 miles to find a Trump supporter. Amazing. Well done. Journalism.
Amy Condon, the editor in the group, do you agree with that criticism?
I think that's an interesting perspective. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I do often find it interesting that when they need a caricature of something, especially national or larger publications, they do turn to the South to find it.
That'll happen. Yeah. Sam?
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. We don't talk about the problems elsewhere as much. It's always racism in the South.
Well, I sort of am thinking about it from a slightly different perspective, and that is sort of the Browning of America, right? And so I thought about Norcross as sort of this microcosm of what is sort of happening to the U.S.
And it is a very dramatic case. I mean, it's not, I mean, I think that everything that everybody is saying here is legitimate, but like it is a newsworthy story. The demographic change in this particular municipality, if you look at it on its own, is one of the most dramatic, I think, depending on how you count it, the most dramatic in the country in recent years.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think that's absolutely true. But at the same time, they didn't use Norcross for what it was. I mean, they used it for that point. I mean, like, for instance, they made this big deal about the Dairy Queen closing. There's a Dairy Queen like half a block from there. It's just got a grill attached to it. You know, they have coffee shops. There's a downtown Lilburn. If you read that article, you get the impression that Lilburn was all used car lots. And that's sort of the problem. It's they decided that they wanted Lilburn to be this other thing to make their point, as opposed to, and I'm sure all of her reporting was fine. It's just the lack of reporting. There was not a whole story about Lilburn. There was a story about one aspect of Lilburn. I don't think that's exactly fair.
Tamika, I interrupted you.
I think the dynamics are interesting in terms of the reporting. But I do think that some of the undercurrents that are in the story provide fodder for things that we have to think about going forward based on the browning of America.
What would the number one thing be?
Good question. The number one thing would be, I'll go back to Sam's point of view, which is, you know, racism. More conversation around sort of how we can build bridges.
All right. We're talking about the week's news with The Break Room here on Second Thought, and we'll move on to a decidedly, I was going to say a lighthearted topic, but then I was trying to make like a medical pun, and I just couldn't do it. And just moving on. Websites like the Atlanta-based WebMD, did you know, is based in Atlanta. These websites can be very useful for a lot of people to find some quick medical information, but some of us can take that medical advice a little bit too far.
Hi, I'm Dr. WebMD.
What is it, Doc?
You have cancer.
How could you possibly know that?
Oh, I tell everyone they have cancer. Why? What seems to be the problem, besides the cancer?
Experts in the medical community have coined a new phrase for people who consistently overdiagnose their own medical symptoms. They call it cyberchondria, play on hyperchondria. It happens when somebody looks at a list of maladies and just assumes that they have one of the worst. Any of you guys have a habit of doing this?
I do this. I'm sad. Yeah. I'll just go ahead and admit it. Don't ever look up abdominal pain, because what it needs to do is say, it's 95% chance it's something you ate. Think about what that might have been. But they don't do that. They're just like, you know, it's either a hernia or it's cancer or it's like your bowels were removed. I mean, it's awful.
It's not a tumor.
No, it might be, though.
I know, but everything has cancer associated with it on WebMD, so just don't go there.
Yeah,
agreed. Right. I don't do this myself, but I can honestly see where it's sort of lending credence to people's condition they already have as far as hypochondria. You're already one. Now you have a place you can go and prove that you have some reason to be one.
Well, biscuits give you cancer. Didn't you know that, Sam?
Oh, everything gives you cancer. Just eat the biscuits.
Amy, maybe you'll defend this. I mean, so I wonder if some of the resistance that doctors exhibit towards sites like WebMD is that they don't like that their monopoly on the information, that their status as an exalted priesthood is being threatened by the democratization of this information. Would you back me up on that?
I will to some extent, because I do research on things before I even go to the doctor and get my list of questions together. And I don't just go to WebMD. I'm like sort of a little nerd that'll read medical journal articles. So I was a caretaker for my mom for a while, and I did that. And the doctors would be like, okay, you seem to have this already figured out. And I'm like, well, no, I just need to know how to proceed here because I'm caring for this person. So I do think that it helps arm patients with more information, and it makes them question things a lot more when they're just sitting there and maybe they're not feeling so well.
That questioning is good too, because oftentimes I felt like it's a guessing game anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so I do think access to this information, at least for me, has put me in the position to ask more questions. Now, I don't self-diagnose as much because I'm the ultimate optimist, So absolutely. I don't want to think I have anything.
I'm just going to go ahead and point out, no disrespect to the Atlanta-based WebMD, but there's also other sites like the Mayo Clinic website, which I think is really, really strong, too. It's Friday. We're in the break room talking about the week's news. I'll mention everybody's names here just in a minute. Coming up next, we'll talk about why debates about fact or fiction have turned into shouting matches. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. We're hanging out in the break room this morning talking about the week's news with Sam Burnham, curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, Tamika DePriest, senior director of communications at Emory University, Stefan Turkheimer, the lawyer and editor for Georgia Poll, and also with us is Amy Condon down in Savannah. She's the associate editor for Savannah Magazine. And we want to thank Savannah Coffee Roasters for donating the coffee that is fueling our break room guests this morning. They're online at savannahcoffee.com. Well, this month, Georgia has declared a level one drought after a very dry summer. At least the second half of the summer was pretty darn dry. State wants to limit water used outdoors during the day. If you sprinkle your lawn during the day, you're going to lose most of it to evaporation anyway. It's just a bad investment. This means that cars might get a little bit dirtier, lawns could turn slightly browner. Water shortages are nothing new in Georgia. And Atlanta gang, I wonder if that's part of the problem here in terms of getting people to observe water shortage recommendations. Like, Atlanta knows from drought. You've seen serious drought, and this just isn't as bad as it's been in years past, right? Not yet, at least.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. You don't have the nightly warnings on the news about how you should not drink any water and try to sort of desiccate yourself personally and get yourself through the day. We don't have that. We don't have Monica Kaufman out there accosting people as they try to water their lawns. And without that, you sort of don't think, well, this is like an orange alert. As someone who doesn't have a lawn myself, I feel, you know, I try to make up for it by taking like really long showers and doing all the things that are necessary to play my part in this Georgia effort to keep the drought going.
Yeah.
Well, I think if you drive by my house at this point, you definitely will see some brown. So I guess I'm participating in the conservation movement, you know, in an indirect way because I'm not watering the grass.
Oh, I see. You're doing it kind of passively, right?
Yeah. Like passively, indeed. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I try to regularly turn the water off while brushing my teeth. Mm-hmm. So maybe that counts as active.
Nice work.
Yeah, I could come on and say that, you know, I haven't been watering my lawn. But that's really not different than any other time. So I would look like some kind of water crusader when I'm really not. But
Amy, is stuff brown down in Savannah?
Yes, but that's because I'm really passive at taking care of my plants and things like that. If you want to kill something green, I'm great at it.
Well, so put it in your lawn. Yeah, you got that.
Put it in my lawn. Because I have people come by all the time and go, do you need me to take care of this for you? And I'm like, no. Really, I'll get to it.
I will say that, like, so my folks came up and visited me in Macon the other week, and they flew into Savannah instead of flying into Atlanta, and they drove I-16 from Savannah up to Macon. And I told my dad, get really, really excited because he's a plant guy. And I was like, you know, I-16 from Savannah to Macon, there's nowhere to eat, but there's like nonstop crepe myrtle as far as the eye can see along that highway corridor. And it's like candy colored, you know, fantasy, you know, yellow brick road kind of thing. And like he got up there and they were all dead. They only started to get, I mean, not dead, but the flowers had passed probably a little bit earlier than they should have. They only started to see some flowers toward when he got toward Macon, and he was very disappointed. So everybody feel bad for dad. Anyways, let's talk about something a little more important. If this year's political season is any indication, it seems that facts are not as important as they used to be. Debates and arguments seem to be completely ignorant of the truth oftentimes and focusing solely on feelings and personal opinions.
That's where the truth lies, right down here in the gut. Do you know you have more nerve endings in your gut than you have in your head? You can look it up. Now I know some of you are going to say I did look it up and that's not true. That's because you looked it up in a book. Next time, look it up in your gut.
Immortal Colbert. Now, we've got author Mark Thompson saying that the truth is no longer important in our society. He writes that Americans now believe that everything is up for interpretation, no matter what the facts might tell us. So the question is, have we given up on truth? Amy, fellow journalist, tell me the answer is no.
No, no. We were talking about that here earlier because we were like, how do we package the truth where people will take it, you know? Do we have to do a better job almost of marketing the truth? I know that sounds like really cynical, but there's got to be a way of getting facts out there and keeping informed where people don't just shut down on it because, and I don't know if that's a delivery or how you present it, but no, we cannot give up on rational thought and making decisions based on good judgment.
No, I would hope that we would not give up on that. But, Stefan, I wonder if maybe part of what's going on here is that with the proliferation of more and more news organizations and sources of information, whether it be Georgia Poll or Breitbart or any number of gajillion things, I wonder if it's not so much that people don't care about facts anymore, but people have actually gotten better at scrutinizing facts. Back in the day when it was just Walter Cronkite telling you what's what and you really had no way to challenge or scrutinize what he was telling you, it seemed really easy to agree on a common set of facts. And in fact, what is a fact is often a lot more slippery than people realize. There's lots of shades of truth.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And most of those websites you're referring to, I noticed you left out the adjective terrible in front of them, but you could have put it back in because, like,
in
most
of your
them,
publication?
Wait, is that an opinion?
It's a fact, but it's also an opinion. The reality is, there's this proliferation of sort of Facebook-ready news sites that are, take headlines and make them just a little better, right? And just take facts and make them just a little better. And as they push it to the extremes, people start trusting them less and less. I mean, part of the problem isn't necessarily that people don't want the facts. It's that they don't trust the person telling them. And that's part of the issue here because there's been a lack of faith in, say, mainstream media. And I don't know that it's necessarily a flight to those other sites. Maybe it is. But if you can achieve someone telling you the opinion you already believe, that's what you want in your news site to some degree. And that's kind of the problem that we've got.
But Tamika, is there not some benefit in getting away from the mono-narrative culture, right, and having lots of different versions of the story?
Well, I was just thinking about sort of satire, sensationalism, sort of the desire for infotainment, and, that mix as it relates to sort of news in terms of, some of these sites that Stefan mentioned. But I also was thinking about sort of this penchant in society for sort of disregarding facts. So, for example, I think of Trump's argument that President Obama was not born in America, right?
Mm-hmm. And which his campaign now says he doesn't believe, but he won't say that he doesn't believe it.
Right. And then, sort of this segment of the population that even after producing, this birth certificate, right, and the detailed one, that, sort of dismisses it. So it's a really, really weird dynamic sort of coming from both sides in terms of what we're seeing in the news landscape and how journalism has evolved in some ways, and then yet to how the culture of society has changed in terms of rhetoric and what we take for fact versus non-fact.
Biscuits are delicious. That's a fact.
that is a fact.
I think they make you happy and don't cause cancer.
Right.
They probably do cause cancer. Sorry.
The facts you want to believe are the best ones.
Oh, those are the best ones to believe. And you got to factor in, we're 20 years out from a president on TV, discussing the definition of is. And now we're into the birthers and the truthers and all of these other bunches. Your own personal truth. Okay. What is the real truth? A lot of times truth is going to be a black and white issue, not racially, but just it is either true or it's not. I mean, that's it. But, as Stefan said, you make a story better. You make it where you can sell it to your demographic that you're trying to reach, and there you go.
Or shape a point of view.
Yeah.
Or
both.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All very true. I'm just going to say that certainly my experience as a journalist has been a one long education in epistemology, the nature of knowledge. And it is often the case, I find, that we actually don't know a lot of the things that we think we know. The truth is much more elusive than I think that people realize. Sam Burnham is the curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. He was the last person we heard there. He's with our break room gang. Also with him is Tamika DePriest. She's the senior director of communications at Emory University. Stefan Turkheimer is a lawyer and editor for Georgia Poll. And down in Savannah is Amy Condon, associate editor for Savannah Magazine. They are our break room gang, and we're talking about the week's news here on Fridays on Second Thought. Go ahead and move on to interesting story out of Detroit. Students from Detroit Public Schools have filed a lawsuit against the state's education system. Their goal is to make literacy a constitutional right for all students, not just access to education, but the outcome, literacy, making that a right for all students. They argue that students at low-performing schools are denied their basic right to literacy, and the government should be held accountable. This could become a groundbreaking case as it attempts to establish just a new concept for the already established constitutional right to an education. Do we think that American children have a right to literacy? Anybody eager to jump on this?
Yes.
I do.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, let's go to Tamika first.
Yes, children have a right to literacy. So that's out of the way. The underfunding of...
okay.
You know, out of the way. But,
no supporting arguments there?
But the underfunding of education in inner cities is a long-term issue, and Detroit demonstrates what happens when, you know, we don't have any mechanisms to address it. And, you know, at a time when we can figure out how to, you know, increase our tax base to get billion-dollar stadiums in cities... we can't figure out how to make sure our children are educated. So,
but
you can't
Amy,
be an
go ahead, pick it up.
You can't be an active participant in democracy if you are illiterate because you can't read. It affects your ability to work. It affects your ability to engage. Democracy really depends on having people who can actively participate, and it goes back to, if you're underfunding education and you don't have literacy as an absolute requirement to move on and progress, then you are actually taking an entire segment of society and discounting their participation in that society.
No doubt literacy is essential. However, Sam, can the government really guarantee the outcome that a child will be able to read? Instead, I mean, can't all
no.
government do is guarantee the ability to, the chance to learn how to read?
Right. The government cannot guarantee that.
What but they can put teachers in the classroom. Well, they can pay for
put the teachers in the classrooms, give the kids the materials that they need, give them every opportunity, and then, you know, as Amy was just mentioning, be involved as a student. Do your due diligence to achieve literacy. You know, you can't just open a slot in somebody's head and pour education in it. It's something that has to be earned. They have to want it. They have to...
I'm pretty sure we're all going to get a lightning port soon, and that's going to be the only way in. But
right.
Anyway.
No, they're going to remove that.
They're going to take that one out, too?
Only some people are going to get it. I mean, because that's kind of the issue, right? Because it's like you've got this... Their argument is it's not that everybody's not trying. They're not that all the schools aren't trying to make people literate. It's that some people have the necessary resources to do it, and some people don't. And their entire lawsuit is an equal protection suit. They're trying to determine whether or not there's a discrete group of plaintiffs that are being discriminated against, essentially, in a disparate educational environment. And that's the whole nature of this is this group of Michigan plaintiffs a discrete group? Can they fall under equal protection? And that's what's so interesting.
Well, thanks for lawyering the fun out of that one.
Sorry.
We got like 2 minutes. I want to try to get one more education topic in here. There's this ongoing debate in Canada about class curriculum. A Muslim father has determined that his kids should be exempted from a music class on religious grounds. The school refused to grant the request and told the family that music is an essential part of the learning process. Question here is, should parents be allowed to keep their kids out of certain classes in public school? Parents have been able to opt their kids out of other kinds of instruction on religious grounds, like sex ed. Is music in the same category? How do we feel?
I think the arts and music, I think it's very important to our culture. I think it helps us to form our identity. I think it's important. But, again, if you've let kids out of other classes, then I think they have a case.
Man, no. Listen, okay, I understand there's music literacy, but look, that music literacy, all of it, it's all of it's important. And you don't get to pick and choose the curriculum. We're all in this
exactly.
together. This is school. This is indoctrination into our society. We need to make it happen. I know that sounds sarcastic, but I'm being serious.
I'm with you on that. But have you let someone else out of another class?
Have I personally? No. Everyone has to go to all the classes. But this is the thing. We're in this together. We can't do this whole pick and choose. This isn't a buffet.
Right.
This is a price-fixed dinner that we've already paid for.
I'm with you, but you got to be the lawyer for the defense on this one at some point.
We're also talking about Canada, where, you know, which is basically descendant of British common law, and the concept of freedom of religious expression is enshrined in that system, but not as kind of ironclad as it is in ours. Tamika, if someone says music is not okay in my religion, who is the government to say otherwise?
I think that's a tough question, especially, you know, when there's precedent for allowing, you know, these opt-outs based on, I mean, you can make a religious argument to opt out of many kinds of courses. And so, you know, I think it's opening a Pandora's box. So, you know, I agree with Stefan. I'm the product of, you know, sort of an educational perspective that, you know, is centered around well-roundedness. And so you got to have music and from, you know, you need sex education, you know,
hand in hand with music.
Yeah, there
actually.
You go. There you go. You know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Well, okay.
We're not going to top that.
I'm
we're not
going to top that.
We're not going to top that. Let's leave it there.
Well, you got, don't forget about the Canadians and their 55 yard line and no fourth down. I mean, we're talking about Canadians here. So.
And those tiny hard biscuits that we can't call biscuits.
Yeah.
But their prime minister was holding pandas today.
All right, calm down.
They were almost as cute as him.
Exactly.
Amy Condon is the associate editor of Savannah Magazine. Sam Burnham curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Tamika DePriest is a director of communications at Emory University. Stefan Turkheimer is a lawyer and editor of Georgia Poll. It was a lot of fun, guys. Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
Have a good weekend.
And that's it for our show today. Before we go, we want to know, do you think that music should be a mandatory requirement in public school, regardless of any religious objection or any other objection? Are they equally important? Is music equally important with, say, reading or math? Call us at 404-500-9457, 404-500-9457, or on Twitter at OST Talk. I'm Adam Ragusea. Celeste is back at you on Monday. Have a great weekend. It's on Second Thought.